I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, it's Manveen. I'm off today, but in place of the story, we have a special bank holiday treat. We're bringing you an episode of another podcast from the Times Stable, Off Air with Jane and Fee. Last week, they spoke to the renowned author Salman Rushdie and discussed one of the most talked about books of the year, his new memoir, Knife. It describes the moment in 2022 when, having lived in fear of his life for decades, he was suddenly confronted by an attacker wielding a knife. It's an amazing listen.
Now, the author Salman Rushdie won the Booker Prize for his 1981 novel, Midnight's Children. That book went on to win the Best of the Bookers and later something called the Booker of Bookers. But it isn't actually his most famous work. That is the Satanic Verses, which caused such offence in parts of the Islamic world. It was seen by some as an irreverent depiction of the Prophet Muhammad, and some countries banned it. And a few months after it was published, the then supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa ordering Rushdie's execution. And between 1989 and 1998, Salman Rushdie was forced to move home 30 times. Finally, in the August of 2022, Salman was attacked by a young man at a literary event in upstate New York. Miraculously, and it really is miraculous, he survived to write Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. I asked him when he decided he needed to write this.
Well, initially I thought I didn't want to, and then I really thought I did. So I had to change my mind about that. For about 6 months, I really thought I had no interest in writing about it. And then some switch flipped in my head and it became very important to do it. Not exactly as a form of therapy, because, you know, I think writing is writing and therapy is therapy. But it was a way for me to feel that I was regaining some kind of control of the narrative. And that was important to me.
You had had a price on your head for decades. I think it's fair to say that at some level, you knew this was coming, didn't you?
Well, I knew it for a while and then I forgot it. Because, you know, I've of course, in the early years after the attack on the Satanic Verses began, I did think about it. I thought about it quite often, the possibility of an attack. But, you know, I've been living here in New York City for close to 25 years. And for the first 23 of those 25 years, life had gone back to normal, you know, and I was doing everything that writers do. I was going on book tours and readings and lectures and, you know, all the stuff that writers get invited to do. And there had never been a hint of any problem. So I guess I had thought it was behind me, and then unfortunately it wasn't.
Why did you make the decision not to name your attacker at any point in the book?
Well, I just didn't want his name in my book, you know. And I thought he's had his 27 seconds of fame and he should go back to being anonymous and forgotten now.
I was particularly touched by your admission, if you can call it that, that you felt you should have fought back. You seem to have given yourself a really hard time about that. Can you tell me more about it?
Yeah, I just felt like I felt feeble, you know. I thought somebody comes at you, why don't you retaliate? And I mean, everybody close to me has said, don't be stupid. You know, you were 75 years old and unarmed, and he was 24 with a knife. And what do you think you could have done? Which is probably nothing. And also, it all happened very, very fast, you know. And before I knew what was going on, I had been attacked or stabbed for the first time. And after that, there was no possibility of fighting back. So yeah, maybe I was a little too hard on myself. I think I'm feeling a little more generous towards myself now.
Other people did attempt to come to your aid, didn't they?
Yeah, no, well, not just attempt. They certainly saved my life. I mean, first of all, Henry Rees, who was the other person on stage with me, who's also not a young man, he's a man in his 70s, but he rushed across the stage and tackled this assailant, this armed assailant, you know. And then, amazingly, members of the audience, from the front of the audience, rushed up and helped him and pinned down the attacker and restrained him, you know, subdued him. And if that were not the case, you know, I wouldn't be here to have this conversation.
We should say that it occurred, the attack on you, at a very rarefied event. There was nothing about that day that should have made you particularly vulnerable or made you worried about what might happen.
No, the Chautauqua Institution is a beautiful place. It's in Western New York, upstate New York State, and it's kind of bucolic and, you know, leafy and peaceful, and has a long tradition of talks that where people talk openly in an atmosphere of you know, conviviality and so on. And I had actually spoken there before, about 10 or 12 years earlier, and it had been a very nice evening, afternoon, and I assumed it would be the same. But this time, the attacker had somehow seen some notice of my being part of their summer program of events and used it to plan his attack.
He hadn't read the Satanic Verses, had he?
No, he hadn't read anything I'd written. I mean, I think by his own admission, he read at the most 2 pages of something I wrote, which I don't even know what 2 pages. And you know, the internet is full of garbage. I don't even know if there were 2 pages by me. And he'd seen a YouTube video or two in which I'd been interviewed. And that appeared to be enough to persuade him to commit murder, which is a big leap for somebody who's never committed a crime before.
He didn't kill you, obviously. We don't need to emphasise that. But you were very, very severely injured. And I confess that until I read the book, I hadn't realised quite how badly hurt you'd been. Could you just outline the most serious injuries that you had?
Well, there were 15 different wounds. And the most serious of them, obviously, was the injury to my eye, which blinded my right eye. But apart from that, there was a big slash wound under my neck. There was a stab wound in my neck on the right side. There were 3 stab wounds down the center of my torso. There was a quite bad injury to my tongue. I mean, that's just the headlines, you know, but it was a very close thing. My liver was injured. Fortunately, my heart was not injured, but it was, as the doctors afterwards said, bruised, whatever that means. And I was also lucky that the wounds in my neck failed to rupture the artery. Otherwise I wouldn't be here.
Well, were you expected to live?
No, I mean, initially, when they, you know, I was flown by helicopter to the nearest trauma hospital. And the doctors said to me later that when I was brought in off the helicopter, they thought it was probably too late. You know, they doubted that they could save my life. But the surgery then took, I don't exactly know, 8.5 hours, something like that. And fortunately, they proved themselves wrong, and they did save my life.
Had your wife got to you by then?
She got to me before I emerged from the anaesthetic. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what point she arrived, but she was rushing up from New York City by plane. The attack was in local time, like about at 10:45 a.m. And then by the time the surgery was finished and I was out of the anaesthetic, it was evening, and she was there by then.
And obviously the attack made headlines around the world, and you had some very supportive statements from President Biden, President Macron, and the then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson did say something. I mean, I think you feel that it was slightly grudging.
Well, you know, back in the day before he was Prime Minister, at the point that I was awarded my knighthood, he wrote something to the effect that I didn't deserve the knighthood because I wasn't a good enough writer. So I don't know that it came easily to him to be sympathetic, but he did. So there we are.
Yes. And your recovery was long and painful. And I was really struck in the book that you don't shy away from the indignities. You were really very frail and you had an exceptionally tough time.
Yeah, and I was poked and prodded in all sorts of ways. Well, it took months, you know, and because there were, as you say, there were a lot of injuries, and the recovery of some of them was recovered faster than others. You know, the liver has an amazing capacity to regenerate, so that regenerated. But the hardest thing, actually, apart from things healing, was just to regain my physical strength, because I was very weak for a very long time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Did you or were you allowed to look at your injuries, and how aware were you of how badly hurt you'd been?
Well, initially I didn't, because my wife, Eliza, decided wisely that I should not be allowed to look in a mirror, because she thought that if I saw the scale of the injuries, it would actually depress me and reduce my ability to fight back. And so I didn't actually see what I looked like for several weeks, by when I looked a bit better. You know? And later on, because she had been taking photographs and making videos as we'd agreed she should do, when she finally said to me, "Are you ready to see the early images?" And I said, "Yes," I was actually quite shocked by how terrible I'd looked. And I realized that she had been absolutely right to keep me away from that information. It would have been horrifying.
What has she said to you about what it was like for her? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of that dash to your side.
Yeah, it was obviously, you know, horrible for her too, because somebody called her. She doesn't now remember whether it was somebody from the hospital or somebody from the Chautauqua Institution. Somebody called her and said, "You better get up here quickly because he's not going to make it." And so all the time that she was traveling, she had that sentence in her ears, that she was going to see her husband, who might well be dead by the time she arrived. And I mean, it took an amazing act of strength on her part to then suppress all that emotion of her own in order to be there for me.
Would you call yourself, in all honesty, a good patient?
I think I was pretty good to begin with. And then by the time I'd been in hospital for 6 weeks. I think I got a bit impatient and wanted to leave. I wanted to leave a little bit before they wanted to let me out. And in the end, I realized that they were right and I was wrong. And so I became a good patient again.
And how often now do you think back to what happened? Do you dream about it, for example?
I did for a while, but it's receded now. I wouldn't say I never think about it, but it's no longer right at the front of my mind. I think writing the book, in a way, dealt with it for me. It felt like, okay, I've thought it through, and this is what I want to say about it, and I hope people find it touching and affecting. And I also thought, you know, many people have calamity or tragedy in their lives, and maybe they can connect my experience to their own, and if so, that would be a good thing. It might be helpful to a few, one or two people.
There's a part of the book in which you have an imagined conversation with your attacker. Why? Yeah. Why did you want to include that?
Because I felt he was, other than my wife Eliza and myself, he was the third person in the story, and I wanted to try and get a kind of fix on him, you know, because what we know about him is very slight and doesn't seem to add up to enough motivation to commit a crime of this nature. So I wanted to try and imagine myself into his head and see if, you know, using what talent I have as an imaginer and storyteller, to try and find a convincing character in there who at least in my opinion was convincing enough that I would believe that he would be willing to do something like this.
You do say that to be attacked with or by a knife is a peculiarly intimate form of brutal attack, isn't it? It's not, and it sounds absurd, but it's not like being shot.
No, guns can shoot, guns can injure you from far away. A knife attack is right up close and in your face, as it was. You know, I mean, he was right up against me. And then when I fell down, he was actually on top of me. It can't get much more intimate than that. And, you know, even though 27 seconds at first sounds like not very long time, if you think about it, 27 seconds when somebody has a knife and is attacking you is a really long time. And so we had that kind of long moment of a sort of lethal intimacy. And that was another reason I wanted to get to grips with him. You know, I wanted to try and, well, I wanted to think about him. And then I thought, okay, once I've done that, I don't have to think about him again.
He hasn't stood trial yet, has he?
No, I mean, the date, I don't have a firm date yet, but I believe it's coming up in the autumn at some point, September, October, I'm not sure exactly when.
And I appreciate you perhaps don't want to anticipate that, but will that be exceptionally difficult?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, I can't really draw a line under this event until the trial has happened, or until he's been sentenced. And I believe, I mean, I've had a conversation or two with the district attorney, the local district attorney, who does want me to testify. And so if that is the case, and if I'm needed, I will go and do it. Yeah.
Bearing in mind not just this dreadful attack and the suffering you've been through, and Eliza and the rest of your close family as well, and the years before when it must have been, if not at the forefront of your mind, then definitely on your mind. Yeah. To what degree do you regret writing the Satanic Verses?
Not in the slightest. Not in the slightest. I mean, I think it's one of the better books I've written. And you know, there are a lot of people around the world. I mean, it's published in more than 40 languages. There's a lot of people around the world who really like it. I mean, who even love it. And I don't see why their opinion is less important than the opinion of people who attacked it mostly without reading it. No, I'm proud of all my books, and including that one.
But you were attacked in such a vicious way with a knife. I mean, we could say that words are your weapons. But there must have been times when you just felt they were not enough. Or don't you feel that way?
Well, I felt that way to begin with, yes. I mean, I think, you know, the attack was in August of 2022. And really, it was about February, 6 months later, before I could even think about words, you know, they just felt inadequate. And then I thought, oh, I guess I just pulled myself together a little bit and thought, this is the tool you have, so use it to respond. And that's what I did.
I know I have read that you say if Donald Trump is re-elected, you would consider coming back to the UK to live. Is that the case?
Oh, I think I spoke too rashly, really. I mean, I'd love coming to London to see family and friends. And by the way, they really like coming to New York to be here. So I'm not sure that I need to flee. Also, New York is not Trump country. You know, even when he was president before, New York still felt like New York. And I mean, he got almost no votes here. And I expect that to happen again. So there are parts of America that are Trump country and which are less likable to visit. But New York City is just fine, I think.
And what would you say to those people, Jewish people, for example, in London right now, who say that they don't feel entirely safe going into the centre of London at the weekend because of the pro-Palestinian marches? And I'm not criticising the pro-Palestinian marches. I'm just saying that it's rather a tough time to be, in quotes, visibly Jewish in London at the moment. What are your thoughts on that?
The world is insane right now. People are very, very angry and seem to have no way of talking to each other. And that's sad. I mean, I'm truthfully a little bit out of the loop of what's happening in London because I haven't been there for a while. But I can well understand the nervousness that people feel.
But you stick to your belief that whoever you are, whatever you are, you should be entirely free to write and say what you think.
Yeah, I mean, of course, because the alternative to that is that nothing can be said. You know, if something that offends somebody can be, you know, proscribed because it does that, well, everything offends somebody, you know, and so if that's the rule, then nothing can be said at all. So it's better, I think, to, you know, as the saying goes, let 1,000 voices speak. And I mean, the defense of free speech has always included the defense of people you don't agree with, because otherwise it's not the defense of free speech. And therefore, quite often, the defense of free speech is a little ugly because you have to defend people who are saying things that you really despise. But you, in order to create the arena in which free expression exists, you have to defend that as well as the stuff that you like.
And you have done that. You have spoken out in support of people whose views you find difficult?
Yeah, I mean, of course. All the time, you know, people write books or make videos that I find them reprehensible. But to say that they should be banned is a step too far in my view. I mean, there was once, soon after the attack on the Satanic Verses began, there was a Pakistani film in which I was the villain and the heroes were the people trying to murder me. And I defend that film was refused a certificate in the UK. And I defended it against the ban. And as a result of my intervention, the film was given a certificate and fortunately did really badly.
So you had the last laugh there. But that must really disturb your critics. When you're prepared to do that, to stand up and do that, where do they go from there?
Well, they should think about their own positions, you know. It's very easy to abuse somebody. It's the defense of free expression is a tough thing to do. And it does involve defending people that you dislike, you know. So we all have to do that if we're in that game.
Can I just ask finally, to what degree you've been changed by the attack? Has it made you, I don't know, harder to live with, easier to live with, more humble? What would you say?
Oh, I think I'm a really piece of cake to live with. But there's two differences, I think, seriously. One is that I'm not as strong physically as I used to be. My physical strength has not come back 100%. I don't know if it gradually will. And the other is, I think when you have a really close encounter with death, when you get a really good look at it, it never entirely goes away. It's always, there's always a shadow in your thoughts, in your mind. And I think that's what happened to me. I think I now have a closer acquaintance with the end, which will come to us all, but we don't usually, I think, spend our lives thinking about it. Well, I do.
That is Salman Rushdie talking about his book Knife Meditations After an Attempted Murder, and just acknowledging there, Fee, that obviously after that incident, he not surprisingly at all, does find himself thinking a lot more about death and mortality, and it's not remotely surprising, is it?
No.
I don't know how. And I was particularly struck by his agonising over whether he was then 75 at the time of the attack, whether he could have or should have fought back. But you can't.
No.
I mean, it was a 27-second, as he said, frenzied attack, and people did come to his aid, but none of us know how we'd react and how quickly we'd react in those circumstances. So the book is really... I must admit, I'm not an expert on his novels at all, but this is well worth reading if you want to know something about just the obvious and horrendous impact of an incident like that on anybody. So it's out now and it's called, quite simply, Knife.
That was Jane and Fee talking to Salman Rushdie. And just a reminder, you can catch them live on Times Radio weekdays between 3 and 5 p.m. or download their podcast, Off Air with Jane and Fee. I hope you enjoy what's left of the long weekend. We'll be back tomorrow with a new episode of The Story. See you then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.